I stare back at Xander, not sure how to respond.
It's easy to throw a game of skill, especially when it's a big group, or a game like check, when you can put your pieces in harm's way and make it look natural. But today, in a game of chance, one-on-one, he didn't lose. He's no fool. He knew that I was watching.
Xander grins, then his face gets puzzled.
What I don't understand is why.
Why what?
Why would he throw so many games? He knows the officials watch us. He knows they're looking for people who can play well. He knows our play probably influences what vocations they assign us. It doesn't make sense. Why wouldn't he want them to know how smart he is? Because he is smart.
You're not going to tell anyone about this, are you? Suddenly, I am very worried for Kai.
Of course not, Xander says thoughtfully. He must have his reasons. I can respect that.
Xander's right. Kai does have his reasons, and they are good ones. I read them on the last napkin. The one with the stains that I know must be tomato sauce, but that look like blood. Old blood.
Let's play one more time,
Kai says when we get back, his eyes on Xander. They flicker once, and I think he's looked down at my hand in Xander's, but I can't be sure. His face shows nothing.
All right, Xander says. Chance or skill?
Skill,
Kai suggests, and something in his eyes suggests that he might not throw the game this time. He might be in it to win. Em rolls her eyes at me and gestures at the boys as if to say, Can you believe how primitive this is? But we both follow them to another table. Livy comes too. I sit between Kai and Xander, equidistant from both of them. It's as if I'm a piece of metal and they are two magnets and there's a pull from either side. They've both taken risks for me. Xander with the artifact, Kai with the poem and the writing. Xander is my match and my oldest friend and one of the best people I know. When I kissed him, it was sweet. I'm drawn to him and tied to him with the cords of 1,000 different memories. Kai is not my match, but he might have been. He's the one who taught me how to write my name, how to keep the poems, how to build a tower of rocks that looks like it should fall, but doesn't. I have never kissed him, and I don't know if I ever will. But I think it might be more than sweet. It is almost uncomfortable, this awareness of him. Each pause, each movement when he places a piece on the black and gray board. I want to reach out and grab his hand and hold it to me, right over my heart, right where it aches the most. I don't know if doing that would heal me or make my heart break entirely, but either way, this constant hungry waiting would be over. Xander plays with daring and intelligence, Kai with a kind of deep and calculated intuition. Both are strong. They're so evenly matched. It's Kai's move. In the quiet before Kai takes his turn, Xander watches him carefully. Kai's hand hovers over the board. For a moment, as he holds the piece in the air, I see where he could put it to win, and I know he sees it too. That he planned the whole game for that last move. He looks at Xander, and Xander looks back, both of them locked in some kind of challenge that seems to run deeper and older than what's happening here on this board. Then Kai moves his hand and puts his piece down in a spot where Xander can overtake him for the win. Kai doesn't hesitate once he places the piece. He sets it down with a solid sound and leans back in his chair, looking up at the ceiling. I think I see the slightest hint of a smile on his lips, but I can't be sure. It's gone faster than a snowflake on an air train track. Kai's move may not be the brilliant one I know he could have made, but it's not stupid either. He made the move of an average player. When he looks back down from the ceiling, he meets my gaze and holds it, as he held the game piece earlier before putting it down. He tells me something in that silent pause that he cannot say out loud. Kai can play this game. He can play all of their games, including the one in front of him that he just lost. He knows exactly how to play, and that's why he loses every time. Chapter 21. I have a hard time concentrating at sorting the next day. Sundays are for work. There are no leisure activities, so I won't likely see Kai until Monday. I can't talk to him about his story until then. I can't say, "I'm sorry about your parents." I said those words before, when he first came to live with the Markhams, and we all welcomed him and expressed our condolences. But it's different now that I really know what happened. Before, I knew they died, but I didn't know how. I didn't know that he saw it rain down from the sky while he watched, helpless. Burning the napkin with that part of his story on it is one of the hardest things I've ever done. Like the books out at the restoration site, like Grandfather's poem, I am turning Kai's story, bit by bit, into ash and nothing. Except, he remembers it. And now I do, too. A message from Nora appears on my screen, interrupting my sort.
Please report to the supervisor's station.
I lift my head to look across the sorting slots toward Nora, and then I stand straight up in surprise. The officials are back for me. They watch me as I walk along the aisles of other workers, and I think I see approval in their eyes. I feel relieved.
Congratulations,
the gray-haired official tells me when I reach them.
You scored very well on your test.
Thank you, I say, as I always do to the officials. But this time I mean it.
The next step is a real-life sort,
the official tells me.
At some point in the next week, we will come and escort you to the site of the test.
I nod. I've heard about this, too. They'll take you to sort something real. Actual data, like news, or actual people, or a small subset of a school class, to see if you can apply things in the real world. If you can, you move on to the next step, which is likely your final work position. This is happening quickly. In fact, everything seems hurried lately. The hasty removal of the artifacts from personal residences, my mother's sudden trip, and now this, more and more of us leaving school early in the year. The officials wait for me to respond. Thank you, I say. In the afternoon, my mother receives a message at work. Go home and pack. She is needed for another trip. It may be even longer than the last one. I can tell my father doesn't like this, and neither does Bram. Neither do I, as a matter of fact. I sit on the bed and watch her as she packs. She folds her two extra sets of plain clothes. She folds her pajamas, underclothes, socks. She opens her tablet container and checks the tablets. She's missing one, the green tablet. She glances up at me and I look away. It makes me think that perhaps these trips are harder than they seem, and I realize that I haven't seen an example of her weakness. I've seen an example of her strength. What she's dealing with is difficult enough to make her take the green tablet, so it must also be difficult to keep inside, to not share with us. But she is strong, and she keeps the secrets because it protects us.
Kasia? Molly?
My father walks into the room, and I stand up to leave. I move quickly over to my mother to embrace her. When I step back, our eyes meet, and I smile at her. I want her to know that I shouldn't have looked away earlier. I'm not ashamed of her. I know how hard it is to keep a secret. I may be a sorter like my father and my grandfather before me, but I am also my mother's daughter. On Monday morning, Kai and I walk into the trees and find the spot where we stopped the time before. We start marking again with red flags. I wish it were so easy to begin where we left off in other ways. At first I hesitate, not wanting to disturb the peace of these woods with the horror of the outer provinces. But he has suffered so long alone that I can't bear to make him wait one more minute. Kai, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry they are gone. He doesn't say anything, but bends to tie a red cloth around a particularly thorny shrub. His hands shake a bit. I know what that brief moment of losing control means for someone like Kai, and I want to comfort him. I place my hand on his back, gently, softly, just enough so that he knows I am there. As my hand meets the cloth of his shirt, He spins around and I pull back when I see the pain in his eyes. His look begs me not to say any more. It is enough that I know. It may be too much. "Who's Sisyphus?" I ask, trying to think of something to distract him. "You mentioned his name once when the officer told us that we were going to start coming to the hill."
"Someone whose story has been told for a long time."
Kai stands up and starts walking again. I can tell that he needs to keep moving today.
"It was one of my father's favorite stories to tell. I think he wanted to be like Sisyphus, because Sisyphus was crafty and sneaky and always causing trouble for the society and the officials."
Kai's never talked about his father before. Kai's voice sounds flat. I can't tell from his tone how he feels about the man who died years ago, the man whose name Kai held in his hand in the picture.
"There's a story about how Sisyphus once asked an official to show him how a weapon worked, and then he turned it on the official."
I must look shocked, but Kai seems to have anticipated my surprise. His eyes are kind as he explains.
"It's an old story from back when the officials carried weapons. They don't use them anymore."
What he doesn't say, but what we both know, is they don't have to. The threat of reclassification is enough to keep almost everyone in line. Kai turns back, pushes his way ahead. I watch him move, the muscles in his back inches away from me. I follow close so that I can slip through the branches he holds back for me. The smell of the forest seems, for a moment, to be simply the smell of him. I wonder what sage smells like, the smell he said was his favorite in his old life. I hope that the smell of this forest is his favorite now. I know it is mine.
"The society decided that they needed to give Sisyphus a punishment, a special one, because he dared to think he could be as clever as one of them. When he wasn't an official or even a citizen, he was nothing, an aberration from the outer provinces."
"What did they do to him?"
"They gave him a job. He had to roll a rock, a huge one, to the top of a mountain."
"Well, that doesn't sound so terrible." There's relief in my voice. If the story ends well for Sisyphus, maybe it can end well for Kai.
"It wasn't as easy as it sounds. As he was about to reach the top, the rock rolled back to the bottom and he had to start again. That happened every time. He never got the rock to the top. He went on pushing forever."
"I see," I say, realizing why our hikes on the little hill reminded Kai of Sisyphus. Day after day, we did the same thing, climbed back up and came back down. But we did make it to the top of the little hill.
"We were never allowed to stay there for long,"
Kai points out. "Was he from your province?" I stop for a moment, thinking I've heard the officer's whistle, but it's merely a shrill bird call from the canopy of leaves above us.
"I don't know. I don't know if he's real,"
Kai says.
"If he ever existed."
"Then why tell his story?" I don't understand, and for a second I feel betrayed. Why did Kai tell me about this person and make me feel empathy for him when there's no proof that he ever lived at all? Kai pauses for a moment before he answers, his eyes wide and deep like the oceans in other tales or like the sky in his own.
"Even if he didn't live his story, enough of us have lived lives just like it. So it's true anyway."
I think about what Kai said while we move again, quickly, tying off areas and helping each other around and through the tangled parts of the forest. There's a smell here that I have smelled before, a smell of decay, but it doesn't seem rotten. It smells almost rich, the scent of the plants returning to the earth, of wood giving way to dust. But the hill could be hiding something. I remember Kai's words and pictures, and I realize that no place is completely good. No place is completely bad. I've been thinking in terms of absolutes. First, I believed our society was perfect. The night they came for our artifacts, I believed it was evil. Now, I simply don't know. Kai blurs the lines for me. He helps me see clearly, too, and I hope I do the same for him. "Why do you throw the games?" I ask him as we pause in a small clearing. His face tightens.
"I have to."
"Every time? Don't you even let yourself think about winning?"
"I always think about winning,"
Kai tells me. There's fire in his eyes again, and he snaps a branch off a tree to make room for us to go through. He tosses the first branch to the side and holds another one back, waiting for me to pass. But I stay right there next to him. He looks down at me, shadows from the leaves crossing his face, and also sun. He's looking at my lips, which makes it hard to speak, even though I know what I want to say. "Xander knows you lose on purpose."
"I know he does,"
Kai says. A smile tugs at the corners of his mouth, like the one I thought I saw last night.
"Any other questions?"
"Just one," I say. "What color are your eyes?" I want to know what he thinks, how he sees himself, the real Kai, when he dares to look.
"Blue,"
he says, sounding surprised.
"They've always been blue."
"Not to me."
"What do they look like to you?"
he says, puzzled, amused, not looking at my mouth anymore, looking into my eyes. "Lots of colors," I say. "At first I thought they were brown. Once I thought they were green, and another time gray. They are most often blue, though."
"What are they now?"
he asks. He widens his eyes a little, leans closer, lets me look as long and as deep as I want. And there's so much to see. They are blue and black and other colors, too, and I know some of what they've seen and what I hope they see now. Me. Kasia. What I feel. Who I am.
"Well?"
Kai asks. "Everything," I tell him. "They're everything." Neither of us moves for a moment, locked instead in each other's eyes and in the branches of this hill we might never finish climbing. I'm the one who moves first. I step past him and push my way through some more tangled leaves, climb over a small fallen tree. Behind me, I hear Kai doing the same. I'm falling in love. I am in love, and it's not with Xander, although I do love him. I'm sure of that, as sure as I am of the fact that what I feel for Kai is something different. As I tie another red flag on the trees and wish for the fall of our society and its systems, including the matching system, so that I can be with Kai, I realize that it is a selfish wish. Even if the fall of our society would make life better for some, it would make it worse for others. Who am I to try to change things, to get greedy and want more? If our society changes and things are different, who am I to tell the girl? The answer is, I'm not anyone. I'm just one of the people who happen to fall in the majority. All my life, the odds have been on my side.
"Kasia,"
Kai says. He snaps another branch off and bends down in a swift movement to write in the thick dirt on the forest floor. He has to push away a layer of leaves and a spider hurries away.
"Look,"
he says, showing me another letter. K. Thankful for the distraction, I crouch down beside him. This letter is more difficult and it takes me several tries to even come close. In spite of my practice with the other letters, my hands are still not used to this, to writing in any way but tapping. When I finally get it right and look up, I see that Kai is grinning at me. "So I've learned K," I say, grinning back. "That's strange. I thought we were going alphabetically."
"We were,"
Kai tells me.
"But I think K is a good letter to know."
"What's my next letter, then?" I ask with mock innocence. "Could it be Y?"
"It could,"
Kai agrees. He's no longer smiling, but his eyes are mischievous. The whistle sounds behind and below us. Hearing it, I wonder how I could have ever thought that the bird call I heard earlier sounded anything like the officer's whistle. One sounds metallic and man-made, and the other is high and clear and lovely. I sigh and brush my hand across the dirt, returning the letters to the earth. Then I reach for a rock to make a cairn. Kai does the same. Together, we build the tower piece by piece. When I put the last rock on top of the pile, Kai puts his hand over mine. I do not pull it away. I do not want anything to fall, and I like the feeling of his rough, warm hand on top of mine with the cool, smooth surface of the rocks underneath. Then I turn my hand slowly so that my palm is up and our fingers intertwine.
I can never be matched,
he says, looking first at our hands and then into my eyes.
I'm an aberration.
He waits for my reaction. But you're not an anomaly, I say, trying to make light of things, knowing immediately that it's a mistake. There's nothing light about this.
Not yet, anyway,
he says, but the humor in his voice sounds forced. It is one thing to make a choice, and it is another thing to never have the chance. For some reason, I feel a sharp, cold loneliness. What would it be like to be alone? To know that you could never choose anything else. That's when I realize that the statistics the officials give us do not matter to me. I know there are many people who are happy, and I am glad for them. But this is Kai. If he is the one person who falls by the wayside while the other 99 are happy and fulfilled, that is not right with me anymore. I realize that I don't care about the officer pacing below, or the other hikers among the trees, or really anything else at all. And that is when I realize how dangerous this truly is. But if you were matched, I say softly, what do you think she'd be like?
You,
he says, almost before I've finished.
You.
We do not kiss. We do nothing but hold on and breathe. But still I know. I cannot go gently now, not even for the sake of my parents, not even for Xander. Chapter 22. A few days later, I sit in language and literacy, staring at the instructor as she talks about the importance of composing succinct messages when communicating via port. Then, as if to illustrate her point, one such message comes through the main port in the classroom.
Kasia Reyes, procedural, infraction. An official will arrive to escort you shortly.
Everyone turns to look at me. The room goes silent. Students stop tapping on their scribes, their fingers stilled. Even the instructor allows an expression of pure surprise to cross her face. She doesn't try to keep teaching. It's been a long time since someone here committed an infraction, especially one announced publicly. I stand up. In some ways, I am ready for this. I expect it. No one can break as many rules as I have and not get caught somehow. Sometime. I gather my reader and scribe, dropping them into my bag with my tablet container. It seems very important, suddenly, to be ready for the official. For I have no doubt which official will come this time. The first one. The one from the green space near the game center. The one who told me everything would be all right and nothing would change with my match. Did she lie to me? Or did she tell the truth and my choices made a lie of her words? The teacher nods to me as I leave the room, and I appreciate this simple courtesy. The hall is empty, long, the floor slick surfaced from a recent cleaning. Yet another place where I cannot run. I don't wait for them to come for me. I walk down the hall, setting my feet precisely on the tile, careful, careful not to slip, not to fall, not to run while they are watching. She is there in the green space next to the school. I have to walk across the paths to sit on another bench under her eye. She waits. I walk. She does not stand to greet me. When I come close to her, I do not sit down. It's bright out here, and I have to squint my eyes against the white of her uniform and the metal of the bench, both dazzling, sharp, crisp in the sunlight. I wonder if she and I see things differently, now that we don't just see what we hope to see.
Hello, Kasia, she says.
Hello,
Your name has come up lately in several society departments.
She gestures for me to sit.
Why do you think that is?
There could be any number of reasons, I think to myself. Where do I begin? I've hidden artifacts, read stolen poems, learned how to write. I've fallen in love with someone who's not my match, and I'm keeping that fact from my match. I'm not sure, I say. She laughs.
Oh, Kasia, you were so honest with me the last time we talked. I should have known it might not last.
She points at the spot on the bench next to her.
Sit down.
I obey. The sun shines almost directly overhead, the light unflattering. Her skin looks papery and misted with sweat. Her edges seem blurred, her uniform and its insignia small, less powerful than the last time we talked. I tell myself this so that I won't panic, so that I won't give anything away, especially Kai.
There's no need to be modest, she says. Surely you have some idea of how well you performed on your sorting test.
Thank goodness. Is that why she's here? But what about the infraction?
You have the highest score of the year. Of course, everyone is fighting to get you assigned to their department for your vocation. We in the match department are always looking for a good sorter.
She smiles at me, like last time. She offers relief and comfort, reassurance about my place in the society. I wonder why I hate her so much. In a moment, I know.
Of course, she says,
her tone now touched with what sounds like regret.
I had to tell the testing officials that unless we see a change in some of your personal relationships, we would be averse to hiring you. And I had to mention to them that you might also be unfit for other sorting-related work if these things keep up.
She doesn't look at me as she says all of this. She watches the fountain in the center of this green space, which I suddenly notice is dry. Then she turns her gaze on me, and I feel my heart racing, my pulse pounding clear to my fingertips. She knows. Something, at least, if not everything.
Kasia, she says kindly. Teenagers are hot-blooded, rebellious. It's part of growing up. In fact, when I checked your data, you were predicted to have some of these feelings.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Of course you do, Kasia. But it's nothing to worry about. You might have certain feelings for Kai Markham now, but by the time you are 21, there is a 95% chance that it will all be over.
Kai and I are friends. We're hiking partners.
Don't you think this happens quite often?
The official says, sounding amused.
Almost 78% of teenagers who are matched have some kind of youthful fling, and most of those occur within the year or so after the matching. This is not unexpected.
I hate the officials the most when they do this, when they act as if they have seen it all before, as if they have seen me before, when really they have never seen me at all, just my data on a screen.
Usually, all we do in these situations is smile and let things work themselves out, but the stakes are higher for you because of Kai's aberration status. Having a fling with a member of society in good standing is one thing. For the two of you, it's different. If things continue, you could be declared an aberration yourself. Kai Markham, of course, could be sent back to the outer provinces.
My blood runs cold. But she isn't finished with me yet. She moistens her lips, which are as dry as the fountain behind her.
Do you understand?
I can't quit speaking to him. He's my hiking partner. We live in the same neighborhood. She interrupts me.
Of course you may talk with him. There are other lines you should not cross. Kissing, for example.
She smiles at me.
You wouldn't want Xander to know about this, would you? You don't want to lose him, do you?
I am angry, and my face must show it. And what she says is true. I don't want to lose Xander. Kasia, do you regret your decision to be matched? Do you wish that you had chosen to be a single? That's not it.
Then what is it?
I think people should be able to choose who they match with, I say lamely.
Where would it end, Kasia?
She says, her voice patient.
Would you say next that people should be able to choose how many children they have and where they want to live or when they want to die?
I am silent, but not because I agree. I am thinking of Grandfather. Do not go gentle. What infraction have I committed? I ask.
Excuse me?
When they called me out of school over the port, the message said I'd committed an infraction. The official laughs. Her laugh sounds easy and warm, which makes a shiver of cold prickle my scalp.
Ah, that was a mistake. Another one, it seems. They seem to keep happening where you are concerned.
She leans a little closer.
You haven't committed an infraction, Kasia. Yet.
She stands up. I keep my eyes on the dry fountain, willing the water back to it.
This is your warning, Kasia. Do you understand?
I understand, I say to the official. The words are not entirely a lie. I do understand her on some level. I know why she has to keep things safe and stable, and some part of me respects that. I hate that most of all. When I finally meet her gaze, her expression is satisfied. She knows she's won. She sees in my eyes that I won't risk making things worse for Kai.
There's a delivery for you,
Bram tells me when I arrive home, his face eager.
Someone brought it by. It must be something good. I had to have my fingerprint entered in their data pod when I accepted it.
He follows me into the kitchen where a small package sits on the table. Looking at the pulpy brown paper wrapped around it, I think how much of Kai's story he could put on those pages. But he can't do that anymore. It's too dangerous. Still, I can't help but open the paper carefully. I smooth it out neatly, taking my time. This almost drives Bram crazy.
Come on, hurry up!
Deliveries don't happen every day. When Bram and I finally see what's in the package, we both sigh. Bram's is a sigh of disappointment, and mine is a sigh of something else I can't quite define. Longing? Nostalgia? It's the scrap of my dress from the match banquet. In keeping with tradition, they have placed the silk between two pieces of clear glass with a small silver frame around the edge. The glass and the material both reflect the light, blinding me for a moment and reminding me of the glass mirror in my lost compact. I stare at the fabric, trying to remember the night at the match banquet when we were all pink and red and gold and green and violet and blue. Bram groans.
That's all it is? A piece of your dress?
What did you think, Bram? I say, and the acid in my tone surprises me. Did you think they were going to send our artifacts back? Did you think this was going to be your watch? Because it's not. We're not getting any of it back. Not the compact, not the watch, not Grandfather. Shock and hurt register on my brother's face, and before I can say anything, he leaves the room.
Bram?
I call after him.
Bram!
I hear the sound of his door closing. I pick up the box that the framed sample came in. As I do, I realize that it is the perfect size to hold a watch. My brother dared to hope, and I mocked him for it. I want to take this frame and walk to the middle of the green space. I'll stand next to that dry fountain and wait until the official finds me. And when she does and asks me what I'm doing, I'll tell her and everyone else that I know. They are giving us pieces of a real life instead of the whole thing. And I'll tell her that I don't want my life to be samples and scraps, a taste of everything but a meal of nothing. They have perfected the art of giving us just enough freedom, just enough that when we are ready to snap, A little bone is offered, and we roll over, belly up, comfortable and placated like a dog I saw once when we visited my grandparents in the farmlands. They've had decades to perfect this. Why am I surprised when it works on me again and again and again? Even though I am ashamed of myself, I take the bone. I worry it between my teeth. Kai has to be safe. That's what matters. I don't take the green tablet. I'm still stronger than they are. But not strong enough to burn the last bit of Kai's story before reading it, the piece he pressed into my hand on our way back down through the forest. No more after this, I tell myself. Only this, no more. This picture is the first one with color. A red sun, low in the sky, right on the napkin crease again so that it is part of both boys, both lives. The younger Kai has dropped the words of father and mother. They have vanished from the picture. Forgotten or left behind, or so much a part of him that they don't have to be written anymore. He looks over at the older Kai, reaches for him. They were too much to carry, so I left them behind. For a new life, in a new place, but no one forgot who I was. I didn't. And neither did the people who watch. They watched for years. They watch now. The older, current Kai's hands are in handlocks in front of him, an official on each side. He's colored his hands red, too. I don't know if he means to represent the way they look after he's been working, or if he means something more literal. His parents' blood still on his hands from all those years ago, even though he did not kill them. The hands of the officials are red, too, and I recognize one of them. He's caught her face in a few lines, a few sharp strokes. My official. She came for him, too. Chapter 23. The next morning, I wake to a shrieking so high and keening that I bolt straight out of bed, tearing the sleep tags from my skin.
Bram!
I scream. He is not in his room. I run down the hall to my parents' room. My mother came home from her trip last night. They should both be there. But their room is empty, too, and I can tell they left in a hurry. I see twisted sheets and a blanket on the floor. I draw back. It's been a long time since I've seen their bed unmade, and even in the fear of the moment, the intimacy of that tangled bedding catches my eye. Kasia? My mother's voice.
Where are you?
I call in a panic, turning around. She hurries down the hall toward me, still wearing her sleep clothes. Her long blonde hair streams behind her, and she looks almost unearthly until she pulls me into arms that feel real and strong.
What happened? She asks me. Are you all right?
The screaming, I say, looking around her for the source. Just then I hear another sound added to the screaming, the sound of metal on wood.
It's not screaming, my mother says, her voice sad. You're hearing the saws. They're cutting down the maple trees.
I hurry out onto the front steps where Bram and my father also stand. Other families wait outside too, many of them still wearing their sleep clothes like us. This is another intimacy so shocking and unusual that I am taken aback. I can't think of another time when I've seen any of my neighbors dressed like this. Or maybe I can. The time when Patrick Markham went out and walked up and down the street in his sleep clothes after his son died, and Xander's father found him and brought him home. The saw bites into the trunk of our maple tree, slices through so fast and clean that at first I think nothing happened except the scream. The tree seems fine for a brief moment, but it is dead as it stands. Then it falls.
Why?
I ask my mother. When she doesn't answer right away, my father puts his arm around her and tells me,
The maple trees have become too much of a problem. The leaves get too messy in the fall. They're not growing uniformly. For example, ours grew too big. M's is too small. And some of them have diseases, so they all need to be chopped down.
I look at our tree, at its leaves still reaching for the sun, still working to turn light into food.
They don't know they are dead yet. Our yard looks like a different place without the tree standing tall in front of our house. Things seem smaller. I look over at Em's house. Her yard, on the other hand, doesn't look much different now that their sad little tree is gone, the one that never quite grew. It was never much more than a stick stalk of a tree with a little burst of leaves on the top. It's not as bad for Em, I say. Her tree isn't as much of a loss.
It's sad for all of us, my mother says fiercely.
Last night when I couldn't sleep, I crouched down near the wall to listen to her talk with my father. They spoke so softly that I couldn't make out any of the words, but she sounded tired and sad. Eventually I gave up and climbed back into bed. Now she looks angry, standing in front of the house with her arms folded across her chest. The workers with the saws have already moved on to another house now that our tree is down. That part was easy. Tearing up the roots will be the hard part. My father holds my mother close. He doesn't love the trees the way she does, but he loves other things that were destroyed, and he understands. My mother loves the plants. My father loves the history of things. They love each other. And I love them both. It isn't only myself and Kai and Xander I'll hurt if I commit an infraction. It's all these other people I love.
It's a warning, my mother says, almost to herself.
I didn't do anything, Bram exclaims. I haven't even been late to school in weeks.
The warning isn't for you, my mother says. It's for someone else.
My father puts his hands on my mother's shoulders, and it is as though they are alone, the way he looks at her.
Molly, I promise. I didn't.
And at the same time, I open my mouth to say something. I don't know what. Something about what I have done and how this is all my fault. But before my father can finish and I can begin, my mother speaks.
It's a warning for me.
She turns and goes back into the house, brushing a hand across her eyes. As I watch her go, the guilt slices quick through me like the cuts in the tree. I don't think the warning is for my mother. If the officials truly can see my dreams, they should be happy with what I dreamed last night. I burned the last of Kai's story in the incinerator, but afterward I kept thinking of what it showed, what it told me. The sun was red and low in the sky when the officials came to get him. So then, when I dreamed, I saw scene after scene of Kai surrounded by officials in their white uniforms, with a red sky behind him. A glimpse of sun waiting on the horizon. Whether it was rising or setting, I could not tell. I had no sense of direction in the dream. In each dream, he did not show any fear. His hands did not shake, his expression remained calm, but I knew he was afraid, and when the red light of the sun hit his face, it looked like blood. I do not want to see this scene played out in real life, but I have to know more. How did he escape last time? What happened? The two desires struggle within me, the desire to be safe and the desire to know. I cannot tell which one will win. My mother hardly speaks as we ride the train to the Arboretum together. She looks over at me and smiles now and then, but I can tell she's deep in thought. When I ask her questions about her trip, she answers carefully, and finally I stop. Kai rides the same air train we do, and he and I walk together toward the hill. I try to act friendly but reserved, the way we once were around each other, even though I want to touch his hand again, to look in his eyes and ask him about the story, about what happened next. It only takes a few seconds in the forest before I lose control and I have to ask him. I put my hand on his arm as we follow our path to the spot where we last marked. When I touch him, he smiles at me, and it warms my heart and makes it hard to take my hand away, to let go. I don't know if I can do this, despite wanting him to be safe even more than I want him. Kai, an official contacted me yesterday. She knows about us. They know about us. Kai nods.
Of course they do.
Did they talk to you too?
They did.
For someone who has spent his entire life avoiding attention from the officials, he seems remarkably composed about this. His eyes are deep as ever, but there is a calm there that I haven't seen before. Aren't you worried? Kai doesn't answer. Instead, he reaches into the pocket of his shirt and pulls out a paper. He hands it to me. It's different from the brown paper of napkins and wrappers that he's been using. Whiter, smoother. The writing on it is not his own. It's from some kind of port or scribe, but something about it seems foreign. What is this? I ask.
A late birthday present for you. A poem.
My jaw drops. A poem? How? And Kai hurries to reassure me.
Don't worry. We'll destroy the paper soon so we don't get in trouble. It won't take long to memorize.
His face is alight with happiness, and I suddenly realize that Kai looks the slightest bit like Xander, with his face open and happy like this. I am reminded of the shifting faces on the port screen the day after I got my match, when I saw Xander, then Kai. But right now, I see only Kai. Only Kai and no one else. A poem.
Did you write it? No, he says. But it's by the same man who wrote the other poem. Do not go gentle.
How? I ask him. There were no other poems by Dylan Thomas in the port at school. Kai shakes his head, evading my question.
It's not the whole thing. I could only afford part of a stanza.
Before I can ask what he gave in exchange for the poem, he clears his throat a little nervously and looks down at his hands.
I liked it because it mentions a birthday, and because it reminds me of you. How I felt when I saw you that first day, in the water at the pool.
He looks confused, and I see a trace of sadness on his face.
Don't you like it?
I hold the white paper, but my eyes are so blurred with tears that I can't read it. Here, I say, thrusting the poem back at him. Will you read it to me? I turn away and start walking through the trees, staggering almost, so blinded am I by the beauty of his surprise, and so overwhelmed by possibility and impossibility. Behind me, I hear Kai's voice. I stop and listen.
My birthday began with the water. Birds and the birds of the winged trees flying my name. Above the farms and the white horses. And I rose in rainy autumn and walked abroad in a shower of all my days.
I begin walking again, not bothering with cairns or cloths or anything that might slow me down. I'm careless, and I disturb a group of birds, who flutter up and away from us into the sky. White on blue, like the colors of City Hall, like the colors of angels.
They're flying your name,
Kai says from behind me. I turn around and I see him standing in the forest, the white poem in his hand. The birds' cries fly away on the air with them. In the quiet that follows, I don't know who moves first. Kai or me, but soon there we are, standing close but not touching, breathing in but not kissing. Kai leans toward me, his eyes holding mine, near enough that I can hear the slight crackle of the poem as he moves. I close my eyes as his lips touch warm on my cheek. I think of the cottonwood seeds brushing against me that day on the air train, soft, light, full of promise. Chapter 24. Kai gives me three gifts for my birthday. A poem, a kiss, and the hopeless, beautiful belief that things might work. When I open my eyes, as I put my hand up to the place on my cheek where his lips touched, I say, I didn't give you anything on your birthday. I don't even know when it is. And he says,
Don't worry about that.
And I say, What can I do? And he answers,
Let me believe in this, all of this, and you believe it too.
And I do. For one entire day, I let his kiss burn on my cheek and into my blood, and I don't push the memory away. I have kissed and been kissed before. This is different. This, more than my real birthday, the day of the match banquet, feels like a day to mark time by. This kiss, these words, they feel like beginning. I let myself imagine futures that can never be, the two of us together. Even when I sort later that day, I keep my mind on the task at hand by pretending each number sorted is a code, a message to Kai that I will keep our secret. I will keep us safe. I won't reveal a thing. Each sort I perform correctly keeps attention away from us. Since it's not my turn for the sleep tags that night, I let my dreams take me where they will. To my surprise, I don't dream of Kai on the hill. I dream of him sitting on the steps in front of my house, watching the wind shuffle the leaves of the maple tree. I dream of him taking me to the private dining hall and pulling my chair out, bending so close to me that even the pretend candles flutter at his presence. I dream of the two of us digging up the new roses in his yard, and of Kai teaching me how to use the artifact. Everything I dream is something simple and plain and everyday. That's how I know they are dreams. Because the simple and plain and everyday things are the ones that we can never have. How? I ask him the next day on the hill, once we are deep enough into the forest that no one can hear us. How can we believe this might work? You didn't see the official. She threatened to send you back to the outer provinces, Kai. Kai doesn't answer for a moment, and I feel as though I've yelled when really I kept my voice as low as possible. Then we walk past the cairn from our last hike, and he looks straight at me, and I swear I feel that kiss again. But this time, I feel it on my lips instead.
Have you ever heard of the prisoner's dilemma?
Kai asks me. Of course. Is he teasing me? It's the game you played against Xander. We've all played it before.
No, not the game. The society changed the game. I mean, the theory behind the game.
I don't know what he's talking about. I guess not.
If two people commit a crime together, are caught, and then separated and interrogated, what happens?
I'm still lost. I don't know. What?
That's their dilemma. Do they tell on each other in hopes that the officials will go easy on them? A plea bargain? Do they refuse to say anything that would betray their partner? The best scenario is for both to say nothing. Then they can both be safe.
We've stopped near a group of fallen trees. Safe, I say. Kai nods.
But that never happens.
Why not?
Because one prisoner will almost always betray the other. They'll tell what they know to get a break.
I think I know what he's asking me. I'm getting better at reading his eyes, at knowing his thoughts. Perhaps it comes from knowing his story, from finally knowing more of him. I hand him a red cloth. Neither of us try anymore not to let our fingers touch, come together, cling before letting go. Kai continues.
But in the perfect scenario, neither would say anything.
And you think we can do that?
We'll never be safe,
Kai says, brushing my face with his hand.
I finally understand that, but I trust you. We'll keep each other as safe as we can for as long as we can.
Which means that our kisses have to stay promises. Promises left like his first kiss, soft on my cheek. Or like my first kiss to him earlier today, in the palm of his hand. Our lips do not meet, not yet. For once we do that, the infraction will have been committed. The society will be betrayed, and so will Xander. We both know this. How much time can we steal from them, from ourselves? Because I can see in his eyes that he wants that kiss as much as I do. There are other parts to our lives, many hours of work for Kai, sorting and second school for me. But when I look back, I know those moments won't be remembered the way I remember each detail of those days with Kai,
hiking on the hill. Except one memory of a strained Saturday night at the showing theater where Xander holds my hand and Kai acts as though nothing is different. There is a terrible moment at the end when the lights go up and I see the official from the green space looking around. When she meets my eyes and sees my hand in Xander's, she looks at me and gives me a tiny smile and disappears. I glance over at Xander after she's gone, and an ache of longing goes through me, an ache so deep and real that I can still feel it later when I think of that night. The longing isn't for Xander. It's for the way things used to be between us. No secrets, no complications. But still, though I feel guilty about Xander, though I worry for him, these days belong to Kai, to me, to learning more stories and writing more letters. Sometimes Kai asks me if I remember things.
Remember Bram's first day of school?
He asks me one day, as we move fast through the forest to make up for all the time we spent writing earlier on the hike. Of course, I say, breathless from hurrying and from thinking about his hands on mine. Bram wanted to stay home. He caused a scene at the air train stop. Everyone remembers that. Children start first school the autumn after they turn 6. It's supposed to be an important rite of passage, a prequel to the banquets to come. At the end of the first successful day, the children bring a small cake home to eat after dinner, along with a tangle of brightly colored balloons. I don't know which Bram was more excited about, the cake, which we have so rarely, or the balloons, which are unique to the occasion of the first day. That was also the day he would receive his reader and scribe, but Bram didn't care one bit about that part of it. When the time came to board the train to first school, Bram wouldn't get on.
"I don't want to go," he said. "I'll stay here instead."
It was morning, and the station brimmed with people leaving for work and school. Heads turned to look at us as Bram refused to board the air train with my parents. My father looked worried, but my mother took it in stride.
"Don't worry," she whispered to me. "The officials in charge of his preschool care center warned me this might happen. They predicted he'd have a little trouble with this milestone."
Then she knelt down next to him and told him,
"Let's get on the train, Bram. Remember the balloons. Remember the cake."
"I don't want them."
And then, to everyone's surprise, he began to cry. Bram never cried, not even back when he was very small. All the confidence left my mother's face, and she put her arms around him and held him tight. Bram is the second child she thought she might never have. After having me quickly and easily, it took her years to become pregnant with him, and he was born weeks before her 31st birthday, the cutoff age for having children. We all feel lucky to have Bram, but my mother especially. I knew if the crying kept up much longer, we'd be in trouble. Back then, before the personnel shortage began, an official assigned to watch out for problems lived on each street. So I said loudly to Bram,
"Too bad for you. No reader, no scribe. You'll never know how to write. You'll never know how to read."
"That's not true," Bram yelled. "I can learn."
"How?" I asked him. He narrowed his eyes, but at least he stopped crying.
"I don't care if I can't read or write."
"That's fine," I said, and out of the corner of my eye, I saw someone knocking on the official's door at the house right next to the air train stop.